Unitarian Universalists are very active in the community. For us, social action is a kind of religious expression. We are struggling with the many questions raised by the Kelly Thomas story, who is apparently an aggressive, mentally ill, homeless man. Although police brutality is an important issue, the question of how to deal with homeless and mentally ill seems to be a much larger and more complex issue. Our guest speaker today may offer insights based on his professional focus and experience. Today, our guest speaker is Bob Serence, who will discuss the moral and practical challenges of homelessness and mental illness. Mr. Serence is a community services supervisor with the City of Anaheim. He recently worked as a staff analyst for Anaheim's Homeless Prevention and Planning. Since 1999, Bob has worked for nonprofit agencies and the County of Orange with affordable housing and homeless program policy. He has a Master of Divinity from San Francisco Theological Seminary and a Master in Public Administration from McHale State University in Fullerton. Mr. Bob Serence.
I'm very honored and pleased to be with you this morning on a couple of fronts. And the first is that I'm very, as you heard, experienced and knowledgeable about issues related to homelessness for the last over 10 years. I've been working on issues related to homelessness and affordable housing for the county and for local communities, especially in Anaheim. And the issue of homelessness is very near and dear to my heart, and finding solutions and helping people understand how we address homelessness is very important to me. So to be able to speak with you this morning about this very important and relevant issue, especially as we just heard in light of what happened with Kelly Thomas, is very important for me as well. And I look forward to talking with you about it. But secondly, I have always been what I call on a spiritual journey, and I've always been someone who wasn't satisfied with the pat answers. I grew up as a Catholic and later converted to Protestantism when I was in high school, was involved with some pretty evangelical fundamentalist congregations, went to Biola University for a few years, but found that wasn't satisfying to my own journey. I ended up in the Presbyterian Church because I was dating the pastor's daughter, good reason. Went to seminary, was ordained, and served in a church in Lake Arrowhead for about 5 years. Continued on my journey, still participating in a Presbyterian church not too far from here in Garden Grove. But I'm also so very interested in spiritual traditions and the traditions throughout the world. And I've always been intrigued with Unitarian Universalists. So here I am. And I've actually warned a couple of my friends at the Unitarian Church in Anaheim that they might start seeing me there. So I'm so very pleased to be with you this morning. It's my first time in a Unitarian Universalist service. Spent some time reading about your principles and your history, and again, I'm so happy to be here. But let's begin our conversation, our discussion about the moral and practical challenges of mental illness and homelessness. And we start with a journey of three men. The first is my older brother, Raymond, who as a young child showed early signs of mental illness. He would sit and rock back and forth for hours in one place. And on other occasions, he would repeatedly bang his head against a wall. And, you know, in those days, in the early 60s, as we heard, mental illness was a stigma. And my family, especially being an immigrant family, didn't really know how to deal with these things. Throughout his life, he has spoken with imaginary people and would cogently describe the impossible scenarios that were buzzing around in his head. Raymond was diagnosed with schizophrenia early after high school. Yet, even with his mental health issues, he was and remains a very trusting, loving, and generous person. so much so that a constant struggle for our family is fending off people who somehow end up taking advantage of his generosity. He's so quick to bring people into his life. Another person I'll describe to you is Mark. Mark I met several years ago at the church I attend currently, the First Presbyterian Church of Garden Grove, where my sister-in-law, my wife's sister, Reverend Cheryl Rain, is our pastor. Now, Mark sleeps on the concrete pad on a covered porch outside a meeting lounge on the church property. He generally keeps to himself, is respectful, and has developed a cordial relationship with our church staff and many members of the congregation. On occasion, we have asked Mark to quiet himself when he screams at some imaginary person or some other haunting internal conflict. And he's always quick to apologize and to oblige our requests. Though many church members and staff have provided him food and the basic necessities, he typically refuses any offers for public or government assistance. And he has contact with a few relatives who check on him occasionally, but he often states he prefers to live as he does, and besides a shower, meals, and clothing, he really has no other needs. I never met Kelly Thomas, but I followed the local media reports and caught glimpses of his life through the internet. Kelly's family and friends cared for him deeply and for countless years attempted to connect him with resources to help him gain stability and safety. As you know, his life ended tragically through the actions of Fullerton police officers, and the community is searching for answers and for justice. Many hope that Kelly Thomas' death will lead to policies that will help individuals who are homeless and disabled with mental health issues, and other policies that will lead to more humane interactions between this population and police officers. And so this morning we ask ourselves, how did we get to this place where people with mental illness often live without proper care and safe, decent, and affordable housing? What are the causes of homelessness? And what are the values and principles that determine how a community will respond to the needs of the homeless? What are the programs and systems in place that are meant to address homelessness? These are some of the questions that I'd like to explore with you this morning. And today you'll also hear about the solutions at the national level that are currently the hot topic. That also informs how we respond locally. When we think about the causes of homelessness, often people will look back to the 1980s and the Reagan administration as a crucial turning point in the demise of the mental health system in our country and the antecedent rise in homelessness. More accurately, the deinstitutionalization of people with mental illnesses began under the Kennedy administration and the 1963 Community Mental Health Act. The horrific and well-documented abuses that were occurring in state mental hospitals, cruel psychiatric methods like lobotomies, the stigma of mental illness, all these things led activists in the 1960s and even federal research to the conclusion that services would be much better provided and people more humanely integrated through local community-based mental health programs. Unfortunately, that move in 1963 gave state hospitals the license to dump patients back into their home communities without support and program funding. Finally, almost 20 years later, with the Carter administration, the 1980 Mental Health System Act provided a new paradigm and significant funding from the federal agencies to local agencies to provide appropriate care at the community level. It was seen as groundbreaking legislation. Sadly, one of the very first actions of the Reagan administration was to strip away all the funding for this game-changing innovation brought by this act. And the new federalism, or this so-called dismantling of social programs to offset tax breaks given to corporations with the trickle-down economics of the 1980s, this made permanent the deinstitutionalization and the lack of support at a community level for mental health, for people who suffered from mental health issues. And the result of this is today, with the approximately 1 million who are homeless in the United States, more than 40% of these are people with mental health illness, according to the National Coalition for the Homeless. So if we ask ourselves, how did we get here? How did we wind up with a system that leaves people with mental illnesses like Mark and Kelly Thomas on the street without adequate care? We must acknowledge we have systems and structures that have created this problem. U.S. federal policy that deinstitutionalized the mentally ill and did not provide services and funding at the local level have created this direct and visible increase in the homeless population since 1980. Now, there are other structural causes of homelessness, including the lack of low-cost housing and the increased burden to pay rent in Orange County. We know from the Kennedy Commission and other agencies that follow this, it takes about $30 an hour for a person to afford the median priced rent in Orange County. So there are not too many of us who are at that level. There's a lack of health care and mental health care. There's an erosion, or has been an erosion, of public benefits, entitlements, and social programs. And especially in this job market, there is a decrease in the supply of jobs with adequate wages. But along with the structural causes of homelessness, there are also personal factors that lead to homelessness. These include things like substance abuse, mental illness, as we mentioned, poor health, insufficient income, poor credit, the inability to save for a deposit to get into an apartment, and above all, the loss of housing. There is also one other factor that's not often discussed, but one that has a tangible outcome related to homelessness, and that is the role our values and our principles play in determining what our culture or community deems acceptable responses to homelessness. So let's consider some of these community values and principles. One value that many communities hold is a commitment to human and civil rights, where communities place a premium on human and civil rights. There tends to be greater evidence of compassion and inclusion, especially inclusion of those who are judged as being outside of the mainstream. And my observation of communities throughout California, and not based on empirical research, but my observation is more inclusive communities in California like Long Beach, parts of Los Angeles, San Diego, San Francisco, and Santa Monica tend to be the same communities that have the most robust and comprehensive services for homeless and those who are mentally ill. Though this analysis, value analysis, is speculative, I find it's a helpful paradigm to examine the likelihood of broad-based support for homeless services. And conversely, those communities that seem to place a premium on what I call the work ethic, or it's often been called the Protestant work ethic, and material prosperity, these are the same communities that are less likely to find broad support for inclusion of diverse people, and especially the needs of the homeless. So we know that Orange County is renowned as a whole for its challenges with diversity, for the lack of broad-based support for low-income housing, and lack of regional coordination for services for the homeless. The work ethic in Orange County assumes that those who prosper are those who are ambitious and hardworking, and those who don't are simply lazy and are taking advantage of the so-called free rider effect. And communities that rally behind these values are places where it's easier to judge the homeless and suggest their housing challenges would disappear if the homeless would just get off their butts and get a job. But to the contrary, you and I know there are people who work very, very hard, sometimes doing multiple jobs, and still barely survive. Now, this is not to say that hard work is without virtue. What I'm asking us to consider is, do people have value because they work and work hard? Or do people have intrinsic value simply because they are human? In New York, it's well known that New York, the city of New York and the state, is a housing right community where everyone has an opportunity to be housed. It's not a problem of supply. There are some people who will refuse, but it's not because there's not enough housing. So I find it quite instructive in terms of this discussion about values that of the seven Unitarian Universalist principles, the first and second are the inherent worth and dignity of every person, and the second, justice, equity, and compassion in human relations. The prophetic voice of the Unitarian Universalist principles are what's needed in the current conversation about what Fullerton and the rest of North Orange County can do to address homeless individuals, and especially those with mental health issues. These principles and values can be the foundation of the solutions that our community is seeking. You see, for the last 30 years, the approach to addressing homelessness in the United States has been based on this work ethic, which also assumes that people are intrinsically bad or sick and need to be fixed or cured. The approach that developed out of that value has been called the continuum of care, and it operates on the assumption that homeless people somehow screwed up their lives, need emergency housing, and then if they can prove their worth, they can move up to transitional housing, and again, if they prove their worth and get cured of their homelessness, they can finally graduate to permanent housing. It's a model that is pervasive throughout the country and Orange County, and some of our most beloved programs are transitional shelters like New Vista in Fullerton, a program of FIES, Fullerton Interfaith Emergency Services, an organization that has for years been faithfully committed to serving the homeless in this community. Though the continuum of care model has had some modest successes, it's also been well documented that it also perpetuates homelessness, and we can talk about that later in the question time. But it's also a model that is receiving less and less federal funding, and the whole federal movement toward addressing homelessness changed. And it's based on a new paradigm for ending homelessness called the Housing First model, or rapid rehousing. And it's based on human rights values and assumptions. The assumption that safe and decent housing is a basic right for all people, no matter their income or social standing. The Housing First model offers homeless people brief emergency housing, and then after assessing for housing barriers, links people with permanent housing as rapidly as possible, and thereby completely bypassing the transitional shelter system. Then when housing is stabilized, supportive services are offered to these individuals and families to help them address the other personal causes of their homelessness. Now, the idiosyncrasies of homeless people with mental illness requires a unique approach. Most who are mentally ill and homeless will tell you they don't need help, they prefer living on the street, and they feel safer on their own. This response is known as service resistance and is to be expected for many reasons like distrust of authority, especially the police, and countless failed programs, the inability to meet program thresholds in order to qualify for homeless programs, and the despair learned from months, if not years, of homelessness. There are many successful programs throughout the U.S. that combine outreach workers who build trust with the population through intensive and regular contact and permanent housing support that employs a harm reduction model, and I can talk about that later as well. There was an article in the New York Times some while ago, I believe about a year ago, where they documented there was just one remaining homeless person in Times Square because of the successful outreach efforts. I mean, imagine after those outreach efforts, this person is housed. And one local example of permanent supportive housing for the homeless mentally ill is a beautiful jamboree housing development in central Anaheim called Diamond Isle. So there are lots of examples of this methodology. Now, I began talking about a few people in the beginning of my sermon, and we'll return to my brother Raymond. He's fortunate in that he has a family that has the means to provide him with independent housing. Like many people with mental illness, he is highly functional and can do most things without assistance. He's not consistent in taking his medications, but self-medicates with cannabis. I see Raymond at family gatherings where he occasionally disappears and can be heard behind closed doors mumbling to himself. His generous and loving spirit remains, and I am proud of the life he's created. I see Mark on most Sundays, and when I have occasion to stop by the Garden Grove Church during the week, I often encounter him. He recently had his long hair cut short and is clean shaven, and he doesn't look so menacing. I asked him how he was doing and told him he looked good. He thanked me and said he wasn't in need of anything. And though I am tempted to think he really is fine, I have a hard time imagining how comfortable that concrete pad is underneath his sleeping bag. And I worry about his physical and mental health. And though I referred him to outreach workers, I'm confident that their limited resources can offer him adequate assistance. In the County of Orange, there are 4 mental health outreach workers for the entire County of Orange. Words are so inadequate to convey the sadness I feel for Kelly Thomas and his family. I'm a father, and one of my sons is with us this morning. And to consider my son's death, especially at the hands of law enforcement officials who are supposed to protect the public, is inconceivable. Equally sad is knowing Kelly's death did not have to occur. If our community embodied the principles of the inherent worth and dignity of every person and justice, equity, and compassion in human relations, Kelly Thomas would not have died at the Fullerton Transportation Center 7 months ago. If the appropriate structures and resources were in place, Kelly Thomas would not have been homeless and without the mental health care and other assistance he needed. Though it's convenient to lay the blame for his death at the feet of the police officers involved, each of us share responsibility for the current structures that leave individuals who are homeless and mentally ill so vulnerable. So then, let us commit ourselves to be part of the solution. Let us derive inspiration from the 6th of the Unitarian Universalist principles, the goal of world community with peace, liberty, and justice for all.
We have time for some questions and answers.
Sure. So let me repeat the question for the recording. So Jim is asking, are there some established methods or protocols for addressing the homeless that I'm asking the group to consider, or is there some new, or do we have to figure that out? And my answer is, there's been a great deal of research that has showed our previous model, the continuum model, doesn't work. And some of the most prolific writers on this are Martha Burt and a researcher from Penn State, Dennis Culhane. And essentially what we've determined, or what the research has determined, and what the federal funding is now pushing us toward, is this housing first, this rapid rehousing model. In fact, FISE got a grant a few years ago to use this rapid rehousing model. So the challenge in Orange County is that we've had these efforts. Maybe some of you heard of the 10-year plan to end homelessness. I was actually on that committee that worked on developing that plan. The problem is one, most of our service providers are still committed in terms of resources and assets to the transitional housing model. And so there's resistance even within the system. And the second part of that is we know that homelessness is a regional problem. It's not just Fullerton's problem. It's Anaheim's problem, Buena Park's problem, Placentia. You could name the community in Orange County. It's all of our problem. And we can't get policymakers and the political will together to come up with the regional agreements. There's some new work that's going on, but really everybody is afraid that if Fullerton steps up and says, okay, we're going to do something about it, then all the homeless are going to come to Fullerton, right? That's the fear. And what's nice is, what's great is we actually have models to prevent that from happening. We know how to prevent, Fullerton from becoming the locus of all the homeless in Orange County. Well, it's the types of services that you provide, and it is the comprehensiveness of services. I could talk with you more about that. But the short answer is, we know the way, we just got to convince everybody to get on board. And right now, people, the community, at least the community as a whole, Orange County, we're not all on board, even though we have this plan.
Play in that?
You, again, to repeat the question for the recording, so the question is, does the resistance to services have to do with people's unwillingness to participate in their medication therapy, that kind of thing? A piece that I briefly mentioned this in the sermon is an application of permanent supportive housing with, you might be familiar with this, a harm reduction model. And a harm reduction model, which was developed in one example, was trying to address the AIDS epidemic. A harm reduction model says we're not going to try people to abstain from certain behaviors. We're going to try to get them services that prevent the disease. So they started handing out needles to people who were IV drug users. And that was a way to bring them in to initially make a connection with them, provide them with a needed service, but then to move on to the other issues. So when permanent supportive services is offered to the homeless in the classic models, it's a harm reduction model. People can even still be an addict and receive services. There are certain parameters around their use, but it really tries to meet people where they're at, develop caring, trusting relationships, and then move them into therapies and assistance that can help them along.
Yeah.
Let me offer you a little glimmer of hope, because I actually I know of the work, and Rusty Kennedy, who you all know is a Fullerton member of the community, and his father was very involved in affordable housing advocacy in the community. Rusty, who I actually worked for at one time, is the chair of that task force. He and I have had long conversations. He's on board. I know there are many people around the table who get it, who know the new shifts in the direction toward services. The question is, can we get our local electeds to agree with us? That's the hard part. Right, so I'll take some time to respond to that question about public housing. I served as the vice chair for the Kennedy Commission, named after Ralph Kennedy, the affordable housing advocacy group in the County of Orange. And I think the old models, you're right, didn't work. But there are new models for low-income housing, affordable housing, however you want to call it. I like to call it regulated affordable housing. And because, in my view, the type of product that's created now by the Jamboree Housings, by the related companies, by all the great nonprofit and for-profit developers out there, have several components that make these housing products sustainable, beautiful. You wouldn't even know it. In fact, some of the most prolific examples of affordable housing for low-income households are in Irvine. You drive by and you wouldn't even know that they're affordable housing products. And you've got some great products here in Fullerton as well. So there are models for that today that work, that deal with the issues of the past. And I'm a firm believer that we can provide that. It's a matter of a political will. There are models that do away with the Cabrini Greens and all those other horrible housing projects that we had in the past.
Can you tell us a little about how they're different?
Well, first of all, we know that affordable housing works best. Multifamily units in one setting work best when there's professional management. That's a huge piece, because then when you can screen for applicants, you can manage occupancy. Of course, whenever you talk about affordable housing, people say, oh no, it's going to be traffic, crime, you know, all the typical NIMBY kind of responses. But with professional management, occupancy standards, thresholds for who comes in and who comes out, all those are really manageable. And there's now the new affordable housing projects, they work a lot with the community beforehand. People have input in the design. They're beautiful. Beautiful. And they work well. Well, you have to be careful, yeah, when you talk about what is affordable housing, because on the one hand, you have to talk about particular income segments, what's affordable for low-income versus moderate and upper-moderate. And then the other piece is you have to consider all of the factors that qualify for somebody and the different programs. So Section 8 is a different model in some ways to the affordable housing developments that we're talking about. Yes, there is waiting lists. And there's also waiting lists for new developments that come online. And some of those projects have units set aside for Section 8. So it is complex. It's not easy to get. There is not enough supply, especially in Orange County and Southern California. We don't have enough. It's true. Absolutely. And there's actually great examples of that type of approach. One of the wonderful things about being in the information technology age is we can learn quite a bit in a relatively short amount of time. And there have been communities that actually do homeless censuses, and then there's a homeless census that's mandated every 2 years through the federal government. But one recent example is Laguna. Laguna did a study of who are there homeless. And they had various definitions and criteria, but they determined there was a set population. Some of those were folks who were mentally ill. And they could then say, okay, if our population is X, 100, then we could probably solve 100. You know, an issue for 100 people. But the other thing is, you mentioned shared housing as a solution. One of the other approaches in terms of addressing homelessness is what's called a scattered site approach. So that oftentimes if you create a particular development for a particular population, it will become ghettoized or stigmatized. And so there's another way to approach addressing those housing needs is to scatter them throughout a community. So you have these master leases or you get all these properties together that you control and thus have some management of those facilities as well. So you're absolutely on the right target, and it begins with good data and good research, but somebody has to fund that research. It doesn't just happen.